What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Social Standard Podcast. Today we have James Creech, who is a super interesting guest, making some big headways on LinkedIn and in the influencer space. So, James, what's up and welcome.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here.
Yeah. So James is currently the SVP of strategy for Brandwatch, right? You're also an advisor on VidCon. You are a three-time entrepreneur, and you're very involved in the creator space. And you just recently launched a LinkedIn mastery course to help people figure out how to show up on LinkedIn and build their personal brand, correct?
Yep. You're the perfect hype woman.
Can I keep you around for VidCon? Yeah, exactly. Right? I'll be your MC or introducer.
I love it.
Follow you around. Yeah. Well, it's nice to have you here. Oh, and Jake, our head of accounts, is also here.
Yes,
hey.
VP of the Social Standard, that's all you need to know about.
Very good.
Yeah, he'll be a pleasant addition to the conversation. Yeah. So today I really wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on LinkedIn and honestly across the internet with personal branding. So we, as you know, launched a B2B influencer division earlier this year, and there's been a lot going on in that. This is part of our overarching series in terms of, you know, how we're looking at the B2B influencer space through the lens and expertise of B2C creators and B2C experts in the creator space.
Yeah.
So that is you. So with that, I will say, I'll pose this first question is like, what do you see? Let's start kind of in the smaller scale here. What do you see with personal branding going on right now on LinkedIn?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I love that you're focused on it because B2B creators don't get enough attention.
That's right.
And we're trying to, you know, spread the word and encourage people to get more involved. But I think there are a few trends that are informing what's going on. The first is the future of work is changing, right? My grandpa worked at IBM for his entire career and retired and had a nice, you know, life with one company. My dad worked in, I don't know, 3-4 jobs over the course of his lifetime.
Sure.
But my generation and beyond, we are going to have many, many jobs, many different careers and iterations of that.
Right.
And if you look at the data for the U.S. economy, we are going to be a majority freelance workforce by 2027.
Absolutely.
It's
unbelievable.
Yeah. So like within the next 5 years, people, the whole idea of the gig economy or getting together small bands and teams and crews for different project-based work is here to stay.
Yep.
And so the importance of having a personal brand is more important than ever. Add to that the fact that we have embraced this trend towards populism and everything from politics, right? The rise of AOC and Trump and Bernie Sanders through to companies and institutions, right? People have kind of lost their faith in everything from traditional news media to companies. You don't think about the New York Times anymore, or even a company. You don't think about Amazon, it's Jeff Bezos. SpaceX, it's Elon Musk, right?
Yep.
So the individual is
That's
front
the
and center.
The ultimate American thing, right?
Yeah,
to be
totally.
As individualistic as you possibly can.
Exactly. Yeah. So now that we've evolved towards that, you know, individualistic, populist way, the importance of your personal brand is more important than ever, right? Social media has democratized access to that.
Exactly.
Whether it's LinkedIn, Twitter, newsletter, podcasts, you now have space for these B2B creators to emerge and connect.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Wow, well said.
Right? I've been thinking about this for a while. I did a talk on this at Youth Marketing Show in London a few weeks ago, where this is the theme of our conversation at VidCon later this week. So it's very top of mind, and I think those are some of the trends that are influencing.
Absolutely.
You know, and how is that received by a non-American audience, considering the archetypes that you invoke are so uniquely American?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I think it's a theme that's resonating elsewhere, right? Mm-hmm. Because you've seen the growing popularity of LinkedIn, right? I mean, not just reflected in the monthly active users. Their membership now is over 900 million people worldwide.
Yep.
LinkedIn as a platform, they're not shy about this, has moved towards becoming a daily content destination, not just a resume drop. Hey, show up here next time you need a job, right? They want it to be a place for connection and conversation. And LinkedIn is unique in the fact that, like, we show up as our professional selves, right? So there is, you know, it's not anonymous like Reddit. It's not, you know, if we try to avoid it being Facebook. Here's all my personal moments. Some of that creeps in.
Yep.
But it's a place for real conversation about kind of meaningful things that are going on in the world and in your industry.
Sure.
And I think that's super valuable.
No, I agree. And I think also, even Jake, to your point, it's like social media, well, two things. I would say social media across the board has made it more individualistic, even globally. I think that's got to be a trend.
Yep.
And then, you know, you also have with all of the COVID and the more accelerated push into digitization, leaders, brand leaders, CEOs, you know, anyone who's in the C-suite and like honestly even below, they know that they have to show up to be relevant. You have to show up somewhere online to participate in the conversation.
Yep.
And all of that sort of gives way to the rise of this personal brand, and then honestly the rise of the B2B creator.
Yep.
Right? Because it's like all of these things ladder up to say, I actually want to hear from these people, mm-hmm. right? You're not just posting sort of into the druthers of the internet. It's actually something that people are engaging in. And I know you yourself have built over 20,000 followers, right, on LinkedIn, which is, you know, if you're thinking about that in comparison to like a B2C creator, does that sound like a big number?
Depends on who you ask, right? No, it doesn't.
But the reality is it is big on LinkedIn.
Sure.
And it is because LinkedIn is about niches.
Yeah.
Right? And we are also, that's another trend that we're seeing is like the continuation of these niches from the internet.
Uh-huh.
And so when you own your niche, just like a more what we call like traditionally a micro creator on the B2C space, those are the ones that have been able to really monetize their following in interesting ways.
Yeah.
Right.
I want to underscore a couple things you said. Sure. First is that modern leaders have to be creators, right?
Yes.
Like this is not the future. No. This is the present.
That's right.
If you are in a leadership role in an organization, people expect you to have an opinion, right?
Sure.
To share that online and participate in the conversation. So I encourage people like this is how you show up nowadays. That's number one. And then, yes, the relative importance or audience metrics are different for each platform, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Instagram is different from TikTok, is different than LinkedIn, Twitter, et cetera. But, you don't want to get caught up in the vanity metrics of it all.
No.
Like, having a lot of followers is great, right? It's helpful to have an audience. But more than anything, it's about creating community, right? And
that's
conversation
right.
and connection.
Exactly.
LinkedIn is an amazing place for that, right? Like, so I started my journey, encouraged by many others in the space, Brendan Gahan, Phil Ranta, like others who had been active on the platform for years. And I tell people, like, through my LinkedIn Mastery course, I made all the excuses that everybody makes. I'm too busy. I don't know what to say. Who wants to listen to me anyway?
Yep.
But for some reason, COVID said, I'm going to make time for this, right? Like I'm going to dedicate to writing every weekday for a year, which was grueling, but also
that's what Phil said he did as well.
Incredibly enlightening. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. And it is a good way. You know, everyone is different, but knowing my own psychology, part of the reason I did it is if I did it every day, I'd build a habit.
Yeah,
if I told myself, oh, I'll do it once or twice a week, Monday turns into Tuesday, it turns into Friday, and the week is gone. So part of it was just getting that practice in, the repetition, but also figuring out what works, finding my voice as a writer, finding who my audience is and what they care about. And I mean, the results blew me away.
Yeah.
You know, more than anything, it's about like catching up with old connections and friends and like generating new opportunities for angel investments or advisory opportunities or speaking engagements.
Yeah.
And also just like learning a lot in the process, right? Like becoming more informed, learning about our space, writing about it and defending those opinions in public, I think makes you a more well-rounded, capable leader.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're doing all the things that used to be done in real life, right? But you're just now doing it and it's documented.
Yeah,
of
right.
course, the process is documented, but you're doing it in a digital space.
Yeah. And as we all begin to live even more of our lives online,
right.
that becomes important. And it's nice to, have this corpus of information. One of the things I tell people where they say, well, what do I write about on LinkedIn?
Yeah.
Is I say, well, what do you tell people all the time?
Exactly.
Jess, like, what do you tell your clients in every pitch meeting?
Exactly.
Or what do you tell your team in your standups, right?
Yep.
Like, that's great fodder for conversation.
It is.
And now you have a place where you can reference it. Like, here's that post I did about XYZ. You can go read it.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think that's true. And I think even like for us, you know, at the Social Standard, we have our Monday meetings.
Yeah.
And those are always informed by my Friday research, which is where I put together our Social Brew or our Business Brew newsletters.
Yeah.
So it does sort of, I think that's actually one of the things I love about a newsletter is every week I literally sit down and like, oh, I don't want to do it this week. There's so much to do, you know, but then you sit down and you do it and it continues to build that habit.
Yeah.
It gets you going and gets you thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that people write as much as they used to.
Yeah.
You know, if you read back, like, or if you listen to, like, older individuals, you realize that a lot of them kept journals.
Yeah.
Like, daily journals where you were exercising this process and how cathartic that is to just sort of process everything. Because, you know, you think about the short form video craze, the algorithms, all this stuff, and we're just consume online. And no one really has a moment to sit down and like process all the information that is coming at you at a million miles an hour.
Yep.
And I think it's a wonderful way to do that through a newsletter, through an email, through a team meeting preparation, through LinkedIn posts, through tweets, whatever it is. It's a really lovely way to kind of take what you already know and put it to good use for yourself.
Yes. I mean, we live in an era of Slack messages and voice memos and, you know, TikToks, and it's hard to keep up. I think that's obviously, you know, condensed the attention span for a lot of folks, but writing is hopefully not a lost art. It's so valuable for, you know, kind of crystallizing your thought process, sharing that with other people, allowing them the chance to critique it. And newsletters are phenomenal, right? So I love the fact that you have the two newsletters because just for you as an individual, like taking the time to research and share and publish that is so useful. But also, like, open rates on email are still amazing, right? In terms of building a direct relationship with your audience, there's almost no better medium than either a newsletter or a podcast.
And you see that a lot in the publishing space in the last couple of years, the extent to which, you know, publishers that might have, I mean, obviously, you know, on-site strategies are, you know, that is, nobody is necessarily leading with their .com anymore.
Yeah.
And so many of those same publishers have pivoted to heavy reliance on newsletters. I mean, there are media companies now that are effectively just collections of newsletters.
Yeah, right, and really powerful ones. And for, especially for B2B, it makes sense because you own the audience, right? Yeah. I think what we've learned renting our time on these social platforms for so long, and no knock against them, they serve a purpose, and it's great for top of funnel, build the audience, but then channel them to the newsletter, to the podcast, to your site, to your product, a place where you can own the customer relationship. Mm-hmm. So that will continue to be paramount for
B2B. We've seen that with the creator economy, right? B2C creators have been doing this really well for a while, or at least they're starting to figure it out in a lot of ways, right? And so it's really exciting, I think, to see that transition over to B2B, because I think that B2B influencers are literally, they are the original influencer, right? See, like we talk about, you know, CEOs, people who are leaders at all front. It's like you guys are the original influencer in a lot of ways. And so to have them come back and have their moment in time is exciting. And then also, I think for me personally, I've never, even though I've been in this space for like 15 years, I've never once said, hey, I want to be a YouTube influencer or an Instagram influencer. It's just not been my shtick, but then
it's
you
too bad
in.
The money's a lot better.
Yeah,
I think we both made the wrong choice.
I think potentially, but it's just it's a grind, you know. And I think what's interesting about the LinkedIn influencers or being on Twitter with influencers, it's like you have an expertise, you have something to say, and it feels a little bit more like warranted and a little bit less vanity driven.
Yeah, I'm curious to learn more about your experience because as someone who's been in the creator economy for a decade, you know, you wrestle with this fact that like, oh, I'm on the business side and I work with creators and influencers, but that's like over here, it's B2C, it's on these platforms.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, like I've been doing a podcast since 2015. Yeah. I launched my newsletter last year. I've been writing on LinkedIn for, I don't know, 3 years now. And you catch yourself and you're like, wait, am I a creator? Right? Like wrestling with crossing the chasm and moving over into the other side of the equation. Yeah. What's that been like for you?
Yeah. I mean, I just started, I think, on LinkedIn 6 weeks ago, maybe. So it's a very new experience for me, but we've been doing the podcast for, I would say, a better part of two and a half years.
Yep.
And that's been really... And the newsletter. The newsletter for us started, that was sort of my pandemic baby, if you will. That was a way that we had to kind of reinvent ourselves to say, all right, well, we can't in real life go out and buy coffee and lunches and dinners and drinks and fun things for agencies and brands.
Yeah.
So how do we do this? And so we actually started with a roundup of like... interesting activations that were happening digitally as people were making that transition, and it went like it really excelled pretty well, which was exciting. And then we kind of pivoted. We, you know, you go through some grow pains and stuff, and finally I just took it back over, and it's been doing really well. I was actually telling Jake, we had a client call set up early this morning that was a source. It was a leading agency. The CEO gets our newsletter, reads it, and told her social team, get on the phone with these guys and figure out how we can work together.
Right.
And it was like,
nothing more powerful for demand gen than being in the CEO's inbox.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was exciting. I think I got a screenshot of my LinkedIn followers their day and sent it around to the team because so Zendesk is a client of ours.
Yeah.
And the CEO of Zendesk follows me. And I was
amazing.
Like, boom.
Yeah.
Right. So little things like that are really kind of interesting and exciting to see. And I think that that's another thing that is maybe a little bit different about B2B influencers versus B2C is that you don't have to be big. And I know we kind of talked about this a little bit, but you don't have to be big to be impactful.
Correct.
And I think that it ladders up a little bit more closely to how we view micro influencers in B2C, right? And I think also that also brings together challenges because it's like, well, you know, I know you have a nice following, but it's like, I don't know how many brands reach out to you yet, you know, in terms of like sponsorships, but...
Yeah. But I don't know if that's the purpose, right? Like, and when I contrast the differences between B2C, B2B, B2C, obviously, they need to survive on ad monetization, brand sponsorships.
And that's not the case for B2B.
Yeah, like B2B folks tend to be entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, salespeople or marketing folks who are doing social selling, executives, leaders, people who say, well, I'll point you to my products or services, right? In your case, you know, Social Standard is a great resource for you if you're trying to figure out the digital ecosystem. Yeah, and influencer space. But you don't necessarily need ad dollars turned on on your podcast or, you know, a sponsor in your newsletter.
Right.
So the positioning is a little different.
It is.
But yeah, that's one of the kind of fascinating, you know, nuances to observe between the two.
Totally. And you don't need it, but you still might want it.
Yeah.
Right.
I think we'll see more of that. Like, I think we'll start to see sponsored content on LinkedIn. You know, we'll probably see more B2B creators maybe aligning with brands or products in interesting ways. So yes, totally. Stay tuned for that.
Yeah, because they don't, I think LinkedIn, you can't yet do, I know they just released the thought leadership sort of bump where they can do it for employees, but you don't have it where you can do in paid partnership with, right? And so that'll be
the
kind
same
of
disclosure rules
see.
Or hashtag kind of policies as
we'll
you
see,
have on
we'll
platforms.
See how that comes together. But where I think it's interesting too is like, and one of the things that we got stuck in the very beginning, like years ago when you know, I for whatever reason, remember Intel coming and wanting us to do B2B influencers for them. Yeah. And we gave it a shot, but we're like, you know what, this is hard. And B2C is really easy. Mm-hmm. So we just don't have the time to chase this right now.
Yeah.
And then all the reasons that we just kind of laid out have given rise to this situation now. But it's just, it's much easier because you don't have to rely on trying to get in touch with the CEO of OpenAI to talk about AI stuff, right?
Yeah.
There are so many other people who, they're literally their entire role in life seems to be just to be a thought leader and to be an expert.
Or an educator, totally.
An educator, and those people are influencing the influencers. And so I think that that's a really heavy, like, a really good place for B2B brands to be focusing because their, you know, timetables work a little bit better, their audience is more receptive to that content, they're already kind of posting regularly and, like, warming their audience up for these types of things. So for me, I think that's really where I see a lot of potential success for the B2B influencer space.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but, you know, that all that to say, it's like maybe a CEO is going to do something at some point. And, you know, I think that if you look at who your customers are and then you ladder that back, I think that works really well for like a CEO or a CMO or someone, you know, CMO says, hey, we use Slack because of this, this, and this. You know, that's a pretty, I think, traditional approach to B2B marketing.
Yeah.
But how much more interesting is it if now your customers have these huge followings
in
other platforms?
Where do your customers spend time? Who do they trust? Who do they listen to? And then turning them into advocates, turning your employees into employee advocates.
And give them discounts or do things. You know, like there are a lot of trades that you can do that people do with, you know, B2C influencers that makes a ton of sense. And then the CMO can say, hey, well, I'm doing this, but I'm also saving my money, like saving my company a ton of money because
I'm activating
of
this community.
Or,
and exactly.
Yeah. Our brand collabs kind of line up and you start to do, you know, you start to do a lot of different things. So I'm excited about that potential space. I mean, what do you think about, some people say, look, people are a little too precious about their LinkedIn and it doesn't, they don't feel like it makes sense. You're too precious about
yours. You know, I care what these people think of me.
True.
But that matters less and less the more you do.
Right.
And, not that you
absolutely.
Care, not that you don't care, but you have less of a, I think, at least for me, it's like the more often I post, the less crazy I am about every single little detail.
No, for sure.
You know?
Yeah, I think people can be conscientious. Obviously, they should. And it's nice to have a place where people are maybe a little bit more professional or reserved or however, whatever you want to characterize it. But I try to also encourage people to have fun with LinkedIn, right?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't have to be super stuffy. You should show your voice and your personality. I love it when, you know, people shit post on LinkedIn and like troll the bro-tree on the platform.
Totally.
Or people have fun in the comments and make a joke or share like their personal experiences. That's what it should be all about. So.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think, and we've sort of talked about this, and that's one of the reasons Jake is here today, because I was like, we're going to get you going.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I pride myself on otherwise building a social media persona that is too cool for school and fundamentally unserious.
Yeah.
And so to, I think, you know, one of the burdens for, I would imagine a lot of people, maybe, and this just could be uniquely my somewhat more ironic generation, but being earnest, and I think, you know, there is a fear on, you know, on being earnest across most social platforms for the most part.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think that earnestness is, I mean, I think if you're going to be earnest anywhere, it should be LinkedIn, and thusly, I think that it carries a higher risk.
Yeah.
For
the importance of being earnest, your next LinkedIn thought leadership post.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I was going to if I the newsletter title I've dreamed up so far is Thought Thinker.
Yeah.
Because you
someone needs to think,
right? Exactly. So, yeah, exactly.
Might as well be
Jake.
Exactly.
Thank
right. God. Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So we're
very good.
Yeah, we're QAing it. We'll see.
I like it.
We'll see. Well, you gotta hook up here with James and get into his course so you can know all the things.
Yeah.
But you know, to that point though, I think that it does seem to me. Let me know if you guys disagree, but that everyone needs to have a digital presence, no matter what.
Yes.
It doesn't matter if you're trying to sell for yourself, sell for your company, or just be there. You've got to have it, because I mean, even if you just want a job, I think about if I'm coming out of, I hope that I will never be searching for a job. I hope that I'm just always building businesses. Yeah. However, if I was in that position, I think about, if it's me and somebody else and we're neck and neck, basically the same, where are you differentiating yourself? Well, if I have 20,000 followers on LinkedIn and the person I'm competing against has 500, well, that's an obvious choice.
Yeah.
For me as an employer, I would choose the person with the social following that may have the potential to do something.
Right. And there's a few reasons for that. One is if you're hiring for a sales and marketing role and someone has demonstrated, okay, they've built reach, they have an audience, they have relationships and connections, I think obviously that's part of the job. So
exactly.
It makes sense. The other piece is you get to know someone through their content, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is the new calling card. This is how I get to know.
Yeah.
Like we've known each other on LinkedIn for how long before we actually met in person?
Yeah, exactly.
And obviously we have a lot of mutual friends and you know, people to vouch for you. But the fact that I know who you are, I kind of have a sense for your personality and your tone from your podcast and your newsletter. Like that helps me feel like I know you.
Yes.
So.
Exactly. And the parasocial thing. But the interesting thing about LinkedIn influencers is I think that there is a higher propensity to meet in real life.
Yes, for sure.
And that's, I think, where the strength and the power of everything really can happen. Because I know creators can draw people in, but they're drawing them in for different reasons. It's almost more of a celebrity.
Mm.
Whereas I think on the B2B side, there's a celebrity, but it's more of like an expert, someone I want to have a conversation with, and really kind of like dig in with.
Yeah.
And I think
there's real relationships there, right? So
I've
been on the platform since, late aughts, right? Like, so... and when you first got on LinkedIn, it was a lot of early adopters and you could kind of reach out to people and be like, hey Jess, we don't know each other, but we're kind of in the same field. What you're doing is interesting.
Yeah.
Like I'd love to learn more. And people be like, sure, let's jump on a call or we'll meet for coffee.
Yeah.
And then over time, LinkedIn got bigger and you know, with any of these platforms, there's a little bit more spam. There's, you know, like more stuff going on. You don't necessarily want to talk to every single person. But, I found that now rather than it being this, kind of push mechanism of, hey, let's chat. It's a magnet. It's a pull mechanism of I'll share my content. You follow me. We kind of engage in the comments or through DMs.
Sure.
And then it's like, hey, are you going to that event? Or, you know, let's jump on a Zoom or let's meet for drinks and get to know each other. And so, yes, like, you know, LinkedIn is a platform that facilitates more of that IRL connectivity.
Totally. And I think people are way more open to that sort of style of connection now as well, because people are just, especially with remote work. Right. If you're not going into an office, you're not talking to, you know, 50 people a day anyway. So you are a little bit hungrier, I think, for conversations that are relevant in the industry. And so I find that whenever I reach out to someone, most of the time they're receptive in having a conversation, at least at the baseline. Right.
Yeah.
And I think I do think that that's super interesting. And I love that. I just love to see what other people are doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's so cool. And, you see like, hey, well, if this is their path, I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course I could do that. Why couldn't I do that? Why couldn't I start, do keynote or, whatever people are doing, keynoting, they're starting podcasts, or, look what we're doing right here.
Uh-huh.
Right. This was all born off of LinkedIn. I mean, Jake, we hired you off of LinkedIn, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
So it's like LinkedIn, this whole room is basically a LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Do
you think there are any alternatives? Like, do you see this activity happening on platforms?
I think about this all the time. Because firstly, I would say LinkedIn is arguably the most social network at the moment, right? I think it's really where, other than Facebook for, a largely older and mostly non-professional demographic, I think LinkedIn is really where you see the most person-to-person interaction in these.
You're probably right about that, because the original idea of a social network, right, connecting people, fell out of fashion as platforms realized, okay, well, if I push content,
and, right, we can monetize ads significantly.
It's a little bit of a better business. And obviously, like LinkedIn is kind of moving in that direction. But you're right, like there's so much communication that happens on the platform, whereas, you know, maybe less so on Instagram and TikTok over the years relative to the consumption of content.
Correct.
And people are moving to like dark social platforms, direct messages, messaging platforms like Telegram or WhatsApp.
Discord.
So, yeah, exactly.
Actually, we were talking with Leah earlier about the extent to which she's seeing Discord become a resource for professional communities.
I'm in a few networking groups that are
connected
through Discord. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Slack too, but like Discord feels like maybe a better resource for.
Yeah, it
that.
Feels less like you're at work.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Like hearing that alarm bell or getting the notification on Slack feels like, okay, I've got work to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I do think that Discord versus Slack has just built up much more social functionality.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
You know, whether that's voice memos or just custom memes, it's I think that they have built into their UX just kind of more casual interaction that, you know, enables a freer flowing conversation versus Jess's point, whereas, you know, when you're on Slack, you do just kind of tend to feel like you're work is literally just a click away
for sure.
Hey,
so Discord is interesting, but you know, I tend to think of, well, we had almost this kind of B2B platform peak in, call it, early 2021.
Sure.
Clubhouse came on the scene.
Yes.
Everyone was spending time, let's have professional conversations through live audio, Twitter spaces, right?
Patreon,
other platforms, racing to do the same thing. Some of that seems to have cooled off. Some of that has moved to other places. Twitter, you know, is the other obvious example of a B2B platform, right? But for specific communities, like VC, journalism, like sports, like there's some really core active groups.
Yes.
But I wonder if they're going to stay there or if they're moving to new platforms now as
so
a result of.
So I know I read a stat, and this is from LinkedIn, so you always got to kind of, you know.
Grain of salt.
A grain of salt, exactly. Mm-hmm. But I think it said 31% of LinkedIn, senior members of LinkedIn are not on another platform.
Hmm.
So they're not on Twitter. So, you know, and that would be me. Like I'm not on Twitter outside of the social standard.
Sure.
I'm not personally on Twitter.
Yeah.
I like Twitter and it's fine, but I go in and I don't participate necessarily.
Uh-huh.
I consume a little bit every once in a while.
Yep.
But Twitter did just announce that, I think it was last week, but they're talking about now they're going to have a jobs functionality. And I think my guess is that they have seen the success, part of the success that LinkedIn has had driving more businesses there. Because if you have people who are, you know, you've got talent who are now all over LinkedIn because they're looking for jobs. Plus you have senior members of teams who are hiring that are all over. And so it just becomes a natural place to continue to have conversations and be there. And that's something that Twitter needs a little bit more of, you know, at the present time.
Yeah. And also I wonder if the format lends itself, you know, to it, because you don't have just this micro blogging concept.
Right.
It's kind of a little bit more long form.
Yeah.
Right. In nature.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. I mean, I think Twitter has a really interesting opportunity ahead of it in terms of getting into long form content.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that we've seen that start to kind of play out.
Yeah.
But I actually think they could do a really interesting thing there with subscriptions.
Yeah.
You have the short form, which is your advertisement. You have the long form, which drives your revenue. You have a lot of conversations. They're doing picture-in-picture stuff now. So I would say, what I would say about Twitter is what I used to say about Pinterest.
Yep.
Is the only thing that will get in their way are themselves.
Uh-huh.
Right? So if they can if they can get out of their own way, I actually think they have a really good shot at doing a lot of really cool stuff.
And to their credit, Twitter has probably one of the fastest cycles of innovation, right? Like if you follow their announcements, right? Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube tend to be the best at shipping new features. Now, obviously Twitter, sometimes they'll pull those back or it's just beta, but the speed at which they are ideating and innovating is strong.
And I think Twitter is a platform where B2B and B2C creators can both utilize them.
Yeah, you can coexist.
Coexist.
Yep.
And that's really interesting too.
Uh-huh.
I know that creators are migrating a bit to LinkedIn, having some success there, but I just don't think it's the same.
Yeah, and I'm curious about that. You're probably closer to this than I am.
Why,
if I'm a traditional B2C creator, do I want to be on LinkedIn? I imagine it's to connect with brands and agents.
To be in front of brands.
Okay.
It's lead gen, right?
Sense.
I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, without a doubt. I mean, that was always, I remember, in the in the sort of early era of professionalized YouTube, when you saw a lot of creators actually build out LinkedIn profiles, it did seem to me just as sort of a, you know, another marketing channel for their services, you know, as creators, mm-hmm. not necessarily, you know, they weren't per se doing professional networking on there. Mm-hmm. It was about, you know, effectively marketing, you know, per your point, their personal brands.
Yeah.
And I think increasingly, I mean, I don't see that, I don't think that that has abated. But I also, you know, they haven't expanded that use case beyond just sort of, you know, marketing themselves for effectively for brand opportunities.
Yeah, and I don't think they need to necessarily. No. But you do see like the creator economy, like the people who are supporting creators getting on there, like Reed from Night Media.
Yeah, sure.
You know, he does Nightlight. That's his newsletter. Uh-huh. And he talks a lot about the creator economy, and you know that he's an influential guy because he's surrounded by all of these big creators.
Yeah.
So you want to lean. I want to know what he's saying and what he's seeing, because he has a different perspective, right, in terms of like what's actually going on there. Uh-huh. Actually, when we were interviewing for a role, I don't remember, I remember exactly what it was, but I had interviewed a guy who sat in on all the discussions that Mr. Beast would have with the network of creators,
uh-huh.
and they would have, you know, all these learnings, kind of like their stand-ups and their sort of things. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. He'd be a really great guy to hire,
uh-huh.
just because he knows so much about like what's currently trending.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and it makes sense for everyone to have some sort of presence.
Yeah.
I just think it does. My question though is like, and this is something I've been posing to a lot of people this last week, and will, you know, continue all through VidCon and everything, mm-hmm. is where do you think, how do you think this shakes out in terms of like, will there be a line in the sand where people can be like just themselves? This is personal, social, non-work things, and then this is professional. Like, are we, you know, because if everyone's spending more and more time online, that's fine, but you have to be able to cut loose and do some fun things.
Yeah.
Are we talking about America or France?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. America, I would say, but generally, like the broader.
Sure.
But I do think that to some extent it is cultural, right? I mean,
it's probably true.
In America, I think partly why, I think in America in particular, partly why LinkedIn is arguably the most social of social networks is because we tend to, you know, identify much more closely with our vocations.
It's a big part of identity.
You know, whereas in countries such as France, they pass laws where your boss is forbidden to email you after hours. I mean, I think it's going to vary from culture to culture, but, you know, I think America is still the largest global cultural influence. And so, yeah, I mean, for the most part, I think that the, you know, things will trend American until, you know, we lose our own cultural hegemony, which, you know, we never will, because we're the greatest country on earth.
Well, look at that. We could just, you know,
boom,
press forward
go.
On a strong patriotic note. There we go.
Yeah.
The way I look at it is the future of media is increasing fragmentation, right?
Yes,
we started with
100%.
1, 2, 3 TV channels, and now we have hundreds. The same thing with unlimited content choices now, and the same thing is true of platforms and formats. And so with that, you also have a fragmentation of identity, right? The way I show up on LinkedIn may be different than how I connect with friends on a social platform or a dark social conversation like iMessage or WhatsApp. Different than how I talk to family, college friends, people who I have an affinity group, right?
Totally.
Like the people I play tennis or pickleball with.
Yeah.
Like we talk about different things in different spaces in different ways. And that's okay, right? Like that's all elements of your identity, but they're just represented in different ways and on different platforms online.
Yes, so I agree, and I think that mirrors how people do things in real life.
Totally.
I think the distinguishing factor for me is that, like, if I can see all of those conversations that you are having in other places, that's where it gets a little dicey, I think, because, you know, unless you're 100% squeaky clean online, eventually this does come back to bite you. So to me, it's like, is there going to be some sort of, like, somebody has to, like, we were talking about earlier, maybe it was Snapchat, but some platform has got to come up with a way to solve that problem, right?
Well, we live our entire lives online now, right? There's generations who are growing up on the internet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the crazy stuff we may have done as teenagers didn't get captured and recorded and shared with the whole world. And now that looks
like no one can be a politician then anymore.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Like, that's
our careers
done.
Are over, so it's okay.
I think that, you know, just as users and consumers, we're also just much more savvy about kind of gating and curating our fees. And I think that
as adults.
Yes. Right. Right. Exactly. And I think that that's that partly explains the popularity of, or the, you know, the recent popularity of
social,
well,
yeah,
and newsletters in particular,
yeah,
which are effectively just sort of blog 3.5. Mm-hmm. Because I think the conclusion at which a lot of, you know, older people or nearly middle-aged people is your inbox is ultimately your most curatable algorithm. Mm.
Yes.
You know, it really does permit sort of a level of control over the feed of information that, you know, a social platform can't.
Mm-hmm. That's true. But so I think that's what's sort of not dangerous, but it's a little tougher if you are trying to, if you're a news site, for example, if you're trying, yeah, to get a few eyeballs there, because the reality is that everything that we're doing now with all the algorithms is curated specifically for you. So you almost lose the ability to figure out where to go when you want to find something,
right,
in a lot of ways. And I think there are a lot of strengths there, but I think of myself as my own personal examples, like when I'm trying to figure out if I need like an event, like outfit or something,
mm-hmm,
I don't know how to find that on Google anymore.
Mm.
I only know how to go to the brands that I know that are showing up in my inbox,
yeah,
and to what the influencers are sharing about on social.
Right.
That's where I search on social, and I search on the brand sites that I actually, yeah, go to directly.
And that all may change in the next 2 years as AI,
yeah,
replaces search,
that's
right?
True.
Like the way that we interact today is keyboard and mouse,
yeah,
and search, right?
Yeah.
But if we move into a, you know, voice dominated,
yeah,
era, and then
true,
AI curation of, you know, here's your co-pilot or your smart assistant who's,
mm-hmm,
helping you find
all these things.
Yeah, exactly. Like then your entire experience, the way you connect with your devices and your online persona,
yeah,
may change forever.
And I love that too, just to think like if I could use that to search through like, you know, like a Hey Siri moment. Can you, mm-hmm, find what Amber Clark wore when she was pregnant and went to the beach?
Mm-hmm.
And they can surface that,
yep,
swimsuit, and then I can, you know, go and find like maternity based clothing that works,
uh-huh,
in the style that I like. Like that.
It's coming.
Yeah. And that's,
yep,
that's a real like, a really strong case for affiliate.
Uh-huh.
Right? I mean,
totally.
The long tail on affiliate is about to get outrageous.
Yep.
So.
Yes, however, then you are creating incentives that influence the algorithm to inform that answer. And from my perspective, at least the current, the biggest problem currently with, you know, generative AI,
sure,
is its inability to admit when it's wrong.
Oh.
And, you know, I cite this very specific example of just, you know, to the extent that I, like most people, have been worried about how AI might imperil my own job, tasked it with coming up with a talent, with a list of, you know, TikTok creators who met certain parameters. And when I did due diligence to double check these creators, 99% of them just didn't exist. And moreover, you could see a very clear pattern in how it generated these usernames. It was literally some outdoor term underscore and then an alliterative first name. So it was, you know, Mountain Mike or Camping Chris.
Uh-huh.
And I do think we are already at a point where people are putting maybe too much faith in the answers rendered by these generative tools,
yeah,
and that is an uncanny opportunity, I think, for social networks to say, actually, this multitude of opinions, this sort of, you know, morass of ideas and conversation is going to ultimately, you know, deliver a sounder and better conclusion than, you know, than this, you know, nebulous generative thing,
yeah,
that happens across several million servers.
Yeah.
Well, but I think, you know, facts or information is, it's not knowledge.
Right.
And that's the differentiation,
right,
mm-hmm, right, for AI right now.
Right.
It's just, it aggregates things.
Right.
It's not actually, you can't glean anything from what AI tells you.
Yeah.
Right.
At least not yet.
Yeah.
But anyway, that actually got me thinking. It's like, I wonder, now this is not a conversation about AI, but how interesting would it be if you know somebody at, you know, OpenAI, when anyone types in the best influencers in XYZ,
mm,
if you can pay to have a talent management company could pay to have their,
yeah,
roster pop right up.
Sure.
Yeah. That's
right?
Why the affiliate point sort of inspired that reflection because, I mean, then you're in the search business where you are basically paying this thing to surface your product as a top result, you know, contrary to whether or not that might be true.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's just more evidence that search and social are basically the same thing. They're literally going to be the same thing, which will make for some really interesting, it's going to be really interesting to see how like our business evolves over the next couple of years, because we're already, you know, we can already do paid media and we're already getting smarter on SEO because of the way that TikTok searches.
Yeah.
And it's just, those are going to be things that are continuously built out.
Sure.
So it's going to be kind of an exciting time.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned, you know, affiliate as such an important income stream for B2C creators.
Yes.
But imagine that will become of greater importance to B2B talent as
well. You think so?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Like if you could promote something that you're already a fan of, right? That you would use
that's
in
true.
Your work context that you want to, you know, share with your audience.
In my experience, affiliate works best at scale. Right? And so that's, and not that it...
It does, but if the ACV is low, right? In B2B, the ACV is really high, so you don't necessarily need to drive as big a volume of purchases.
That's true.
But if someone signs up for NetSuite because you referred them, that can be meaningful.
Yeah, right. That's true.
However, on the flip side, the presuming, you know, we're talking about a B2B influencer who, you know, is truly a B, and, you know, and is otherwise a working professional, the incentives are, you know, at an affiliate engagement, the incentives are potentially lower, right? Mm-hmm. Because you are being paid, you know, at a cost per action versus, you know, it's not as attractive a sort of ancillary, more passive revenue alternative to maybe somebody that has a day job versus an influencer.
I think what we're really going to see is large B2B creators taking ownership stakes in companies, right?
Yeah. That's
and
a great point.
Either their business or a small minority stake and promoting you know, other entrepreneurs or people that they're aligned with through the power of their distribution online.
Yes. I mean, you're already seeing that on the B2C side as well. I mean, a lot of these, you know, so-called celebrity-founded companies are ultimately just elaborate endorsement deals by pre-existing entities.
True.
Yes, so I guess the net of it is we should all be, well, I guess I don't need to tell you guys, but building up our LinkedIn following. So someone offers us an ownership stake.
Yep, there we go.
I like it. We'll just sort of set up. You can set up your own little incubator and a little VC for all that sort of stuff. Yeah, I mean, I think that's right, especially because, you know, when you look at the VC model, right, obviously it's cash that you're getting, and that's the main thing. But a lot of them, in order to differentiate themselves, will also provide like strategic advisors, or they have the ability to open doors, right? That's basically what Shark Tank is, right? Be able to open doors and do all this sort of stuff for you. That a B2B influencer can absolutely do that. Not only can it be a lead gen, which is maybe the cash component in some case, they probably have the cash to put down. And then on top of that, they actually have, in theory, expertise to drive value for the business.
Yeah.
So that makes them pretty interesting.
Yeah. I'm tempted to go on a tangent about how VC has grown from a cottage industry to a big business. And obviously that has partly coincided.
Tangent away.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah.
To the massive explosion in startups, right?
Like,
yes.
You know, it's easier than ever to start a business now. But, you know.
Some of that also has to do with Fed policy.
Sure.
True.
But it's I think VCs have to respond to the fact that there is greater competition, right, for the demand for capital. But also there's this pressure where we've moved away from an environment in which, you know, VCs, many still do, fund, you know, like hard tech problems or really capital intensive businesses up front, hardware, life sciences, right? Mm-hmm. If you're starting a software business, like you can kind of increasingly do that with pretty low capital requirements. Like,
yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Facebook was started with something like $500,000 in seed capital.
Yeah.
So it just makes you wonder, right? Like if these businesses aren't necessarily as capital intensive as they used to be, what is the value that the VCs offer, right? It has to be differentiated as a result.
Yeah. Oh, that's definitely true. I mean, that's a big reason why I was in private equity a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
And that was one of the reasons I said, this is not a career for me. Because the same thing happens. It's like you look around. I'm like, how many private equity firms can the economy support here at this point? You know, like the goal is to get to the top, right? That's always the best way. But it's just like the value is going down, down, down. And like by the time I get to anywhere where I'm going to be, it's going to be so hard to eke out any value.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the whole model with LBOs, like leverage buyouts, right? Sure. We've gotten troubles like that. We're just financial engineering. And I was like, I'm not here for the technical side of it.
Right.
And I thought VCs were more interesting because you could make bigger bets and you make a lot more of them.
Very different discipline, you know? Right? PE is about noticing, okay, well, there's an imbalance in the market and we can profit off this opportunity.
Yeah.
Whereas VC is betting on the long-term growth potential, which is, you know, a risky game, but
but you have enough bets, one or two of them, and that's their whole thing. But yeah, you're right. It's like, I think even when I first started getting into this business, and I guess it was actually probably like 5 or 6 years after I was in the influencer space, I did have friends who were, you know, at VC funds and PE funds, and they were calling me and say, hey, like influencers, it seems like this is something that's coming up, you know, really big. We think it's going to be big. How do we get into it? I was like, you don't.
Yeah.
Really, you don't, because I don't know how do you exit this? How do you,
right?
What's the recurring revenue? What are you investing in? These are people.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not that you can't do that, but like, I know what the model is that works, that leads to big exits, and I don't see it here.
Yeah. People are still trying to solve that problem, right?
Yeah.
How do we create animation versions of talent? How do we, you know, bring the talent from the forefront to still playing an important role, but diversifying the cast and, and finding ways that these aren't solely reliant on an individual?
Yeah.
Because, yes, you're right. Media companies, especially talent founded or talent led, are very challenging to transition.
Why I knew Endeavor would never IPO, because it just seemed absolutely impossible to me to establish any consistent valuation of a talent agency when at any given time your talent could merely walk out the door.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what's the value's in the contracts? The contracts are short.
Yeah.
Usually, and then if your agent leaves, or they're tied to the agent,
or they're non-existent at all. I remember, you know, I have this very funny anecdote where I was in an agency assistant like everyone else who was trying to make it, who was trying to fulfill their entourage dreams. I remember that when the agent I was working for signed a new client, the client was really intent on, you know, signing whatever was his commitment letter to be represented by this, by ICM. And agent was talking to another agent who was going to be sharing him. And he said, I've never in my life had a client so intent on signing agency papers. In other words, usually they want the most, you know, informal, tangential commitment possible, because they don't want to be, you know, locked or committed to that relationship.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, yeah, I mean, how do you value a company whose assets are effectively, you know,
but they're contracts, right, exactly. And they're not
right, exactly, are wholly non-proprietary.
Well, and I think, I don't know that, I'm not sure if the other ones did it too, but I remember reading about how CAA in the beginning, that's why they always have like 3 or 4 people on every single influencer celebrity that they manage,
because if
someone walks, and someone walks away, they don't feel like they have to go with that person.
Right,
sure.
And then that was also, in the beginning, I thought, oh, this is really interesting to look at how CAA would just do, you know, not just the actors, the actresses.
Uh-huh.
They would also, like, the producers were influencers and directors, and they would kind of cobble together these whole things and build an entire production set from scratch, and they would get a piece of the pie on every single thing. And that's kind of what creators have done.
Yeah, do you see similar parallels in the creator economy? Yeah. Like exclusivity versus people not wanting to commit to longer terms?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, right?
I mean, I think if anything, it's only intensified and accelerated.
Yeah.
Like most things. I mean, like the pace of technology, and particularly technology related to entertainment. But yes, I mean, I think, you know, especially for independent content creators who did not, you know, who can credit themselves with making that on their own to a much greater extent than, you know, might have a offline celebrity 10 years ago who had to abide the, you know, the strictures and the infrastructure of offline entertainment. They are just, you know, by build going to be warier of large infrastructures and formalities and, you know, operationalized institutions as represented by, you know, traditional talent management and agency companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, and I think even The Information had that article earlier in the week, last week maybe, saying that the creator economy has got its reckoning, right? Because you have all these businesses that have tried to capitalize on services and building products around creators.
Yeah.
And then you realize, like, hey, not this isn't as big of a market. It gets a ton of press.
Not everything needs to be the X for creators. Yeah.
Yeah.
Look,
exactly.
I, we are in the midst of a creator economy winter, whether you want to admit
sure.
it or not.
Yeah.
That's the case for a lot of industries.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean amazing entrepreneurs aren't still building incredible
oh,
products.
Oh, exactly. And they're always going to be the rare birds that can do it. Yeah.
But we had such enthusiasm, and mm-hmm. you know, the COVID bump pulled forward so much
yeah.
activity in 21,
totally.
22 that I think, as with any hot space, people rush in that say, oh, dollar signs, like I can make some money here,
mm-hmm.
versus I've spent a decade learning about this industry
yeah.
and passionate about solving this problem, working with creators.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we probably have too many Lincoln Bio companies. We probably
sure.
have too many, you know, XYZ companies. But that's part of building in a new space. You're going to
yeah.
have a lot of people rush in, then the dust settles,
exactly.
right, things shake out, and then you'll have a few winners. But it means great growth and opportunity for
oh,
everyone
100%.
In the space.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of that enthusiasm came on the heels of sort of the vertical video explosion
mm-hmm.
vis-a-vis TikTok.
Yep.
And the whole reason that, you know, that exploded was the extent to which they lowered the barrier to entry. And,
yeah.
you know,
mm-hmm.
as soon as you flood the market with a product, that product is just invariably going to be less valuable.
Yeah. And now we have Reels and we have Shorts and
yeah.
we have Spotlight.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
I know.
Yes.
All these
ad
things.
Ad infinitum.
Yes, yeah, and I think that has been just the sort of fundamental, I mean, I think that we are now facing what has been the sort of, the defining dilemma of vertical video and content, and what are effectively, I think of the latter video platforms, specifically TikTok and Reels, as being less social networks or video platforms than just kind of like
entertainment.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
They're just, you know.
Do I watch TikTok or do I watch Netflix?
Right.
Exactly. Do I play a video
yes.
game or do I,
right,
you know,
exactly.
go see my friends?
They're just viral
yeah.
video machines.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, to the extent that they are thusly invested in constantly surfacing you new content, divorced from your necessarily who you follow or your feed. I think that, you know, by nature, people are just not going to be able to form those intense parasocial connections that they were
yeah.
able to.
Oh, you see yeah. it already, right? Like,
exactly.
How many TikTok stars do you know the name of relative to an Instagram or a YouTube
yeah.
creator? You don't,
totally.
Right? Because what's the genius of TikTok is we kind of went from the early era of entertainment, which was social networking. It's interesting to hear what my friends are doing online
yep.
to, okay, but now there's like professional influencers and creators and they do interesting things all the time.
Yeah.
And they're a little bit more interesting than the people I know in everyday life.
Yeah.
To TikTok says, well, you know, we could just serve you the best of the internet all
yeah.
the time, catered to your personalized
totally.
Whims and preferences, right? That's a lot more interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the next iteration is, of course, generative AI produces the content specifically tailored to your watch history. Like, that's where we're going.
Right.
But the other clever thing about TikTok's business model is, well, in an average session on YouTube, someone watches two videos, right?
Sure.
And maybe
right.
looks at 15 photos on Instagram. Someone watches over 100
yeah.
videos on TikTok.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
that's a lot more attention and opportunities to serve an ad spot, right? If
right.
I can serve an ad in between every third to fifth TikTok video you see, my ad load is a lot higher than you have on YouTube.
Right.
Yeah.
And then that, you know, creates what is their fundamental sort of monetization problem, which is attribution, right?
Mm-hmm.
To whom do you attribute that ad?
Yeah.
The video before or the video after? Or
yeah.
Classic social issue.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. Or the six videos prior that they might have, you know, rewatched three or four more times.
Yeah.
I don't know that
we're ever going to solve multi-touch attribution, but we maybe don't have to, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I think this just kind of replaces what TV was, right? It's like,
right.
here's your general reach, top of funnel, awareness, boosting, and then you could do your more targeted, you know,
yeah.
retargeting work or influencers to drive people to the next stage of a purchase.
Right.
Sure.
You know, it'll
right.
just be a substitute.
But I think people get too, I think brands in general get a little too granular on
uh-huh.
tracking all this stuff. Because even if you like back up before the internet, it's not like when people were creating diaries
hmm.
for what they were listening to on the radio and the ads that they heard, do we really think that was that accurate?
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? It's like yeah. we've sort of over-indexed on our comfort levels with being able to track things.
Yeah, oh, everything's real time, so I should have this data.
Too much faith into it, yeah.
yeah.
I mean, the reality is like, and I think even just to bring it back to B2B influencers or influencers in general, what you're seeing on LinkedIn is like, yeah, if you are everywhere all the time in your niche, by default, you're an elevated status
mm.
because people know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not you're the leading name, or you're or not, you know, or what you would be in, you know, real life. You have the appearance of that, and all the whole internet is based on the appearance of things, right? Whether or not that it's actual fact, we don't know.
Yeah.
But if a brand is everywhere, you're going to buy from them because you just can't get away from them.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So,
I mean, that's been Coca-Cola's marketing strategy for decades.
Yeah, and look, and they're a big brand for a big reason, right? I think people want a discount. I actually had a really interesting conversation with a guy from Chief Outsiders, which is like a fractional CMO based company. And he was saying, look, you know, we are working with a lot of these DTC brands and they just want digital, digital, digital.
Yeah.
They're not interested in trying like mailers, you know, like direct mail and things like that. And he's like, look, it's really effective.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why people have been using this stuff forever. It's not just because the internet wasn't around.
Yeah.
It's because it is really effective. Mm-hmm. And I think we even saw for a while, a couple of years ago, that how cheap television was because no one was on it.
Yeah.
Right. And I saw a lot of like even our clients, some of our clients testing television spots, right? QR codes and all sorts of stuff.
Makes sense.
So, I mean, it's there, but I think this is not a lesson in branding or marketing, but like you have to be in multiple avenues.
Yes.
Like sure, you could start as a digital only brand, but that's not how you get past. If you want to get past 25, 30 million in revenue.
Look at Warby Parker, look at all the D2C success stories, Honest Company, they've all bridged the gap and gone into traditional.
And there's a sizable infrastructure being built out now for companies that provide wholesale solutions for DTC companies to get them into niche boutiques in Brooklyn and Silver Lake.
Presumably with the
plan of owning that, you know, then owning the wholesale relationships to, you know, Walmart and Target.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. I mean, I don't know, when you think about B2B influencers and you think about brands, like in B2B brands, like what would you say they need to focus on predominantly in order to be successful in this space?
Sure. So on the brand side, as we've touched on, I encourage them to find your employees and your customers who are already advocates and amplify that, right? Give them more resources, encourage them, right? Give them early access, discounts, anything you can to promote the content creation and the activity there. The other part is participate in the conversation, show up where your audience is online, encourage that conversation. And then, again, think about how your people, not just in leadership, but throughout the organization, can be thought leaders, right? So you should, particularly if you are an executive, you need to have a presence. You need to be sharing your viewpoints and active online. And then for individuals, right, like think about your personal brand, right? Mm-hmm. It's more important now than ever. It's still, we talk about so much about LinkedIn, but only 1 or 2% of people actually post, right? A lot more people consume content or use it in other ways, but that ratio is only going to grow.
Yeah.
So it's still a great time to get in early and share your thoughts. And then even if you're, you know, maybe hesitant to post or you don't have a fully formed idea, engage, right? Like comment on someone's post, take part in the conversation, share your learnings. You'll learn a lot in the process and the dividends will reveal themselves as you connect with people.
And to kind of baby step it in, I think you can tell where, or at least I feel like I can tell that LinkedIn is in this sort of interesting time where you can still get in, you can make a big impact, you can do a lot of different things. So like don't sleep on it, because we've watched this happen time and time again where brands wait until, oh, I'm not sure if I'm going to be here, I'm not going to be here. And then the price of entry is big.
Right.
You have to buy your way in, whereas now you can kind of earn your way in and you are better for it.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
So the last question I have for you is, we've kind of touched on this a little bit where it's like LinkedIn feels a little Facebook-y sometimes with, you know, oh, I'm getting birthday updates, I'm getting life status updates.
I've seen had a baby. Totally. Yeah.
Exactly. So if people are starting to do that, what is your... what's your take on that? Like, do you think that that's a place for it? Do you think that that works? Does that elevate your personal brand, or do you think it detracts from it?
In general, I err on the side of LinkedIn is not Facebook, right? Sure. So don't overshare. Part of that is because a lot of people will use it as engagement bait. If you post your wedding photo, your baby announcement, people will engage with it.
Yeah.
Does that necessarily elevate you as a thought leader or help you build your audience? Probably not, right?
How savvy is the algorithm at suppressing that stuff to the extent that, say, you know, YouTube
not great.
Has been incredibly savvy at, you know, at suppressing
clicks. Other social platforms' algorithms, you know, look, I don't work for LinkedIn. I'm hypothesizing here based on experience, so this is anecdotal. But it's not as sophisticated as TikTok or
and
YouTube.
And it couldn't be, because it's not been a true social media platform for that long.
So, but it is evolving. It's getting better. And so we've seen things like, you know, people were abusing the notion of a poll before the polls function existed to say, do you think people should work from home or return to office, right? Use the thumbs up if you want to vote for choice A. Use the heart for choice B. And it's like, okay, yes, you're driving engagement. You are essentially gaming the algorithm to show your post more often and serve impressions. LinkedIn has cracked down on that. They have the poll format, which I think is still engagement bait, but I think they're moderating the way in which that is used and how that's shown. I think they are looking at weights to the algorithm that will over time, look, the ultimate currency is time and attention, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, dwell time or participation with a piece of content in a meaningful way will increasingly prevail more in the LinkedIn algorithm than perhaps it does today. And I think that will be a good thing for everyone online. But yes, I would encourage people to say, if you have something personal you want to share, that's okay. Like I wrote a post this week about my father-in-law and I building a dining room table, right? It's like definitely a personal post, but I tied it back to, you know, like a business lesson or a principle in my life, which is that I think as adults, we're hesitant to try new things, right? And to share our stories of being a beginner. And a lot of things have parallels to that, like me starting my journey on LinkedIn. Sure. I know nothing about it, but you have to start somewhere. So you write a post, right? Woodworking, same thing. Like I knew nothing about it, but here was a project that I could do. And sharing the story and the personal experience, but tying that back to a broader theme, I think can be appropriate. So you just have to be careful about how you do it.
Yeah, I think, and I think that's right. Because I think, you know, I was actually talking to our CRO about that. And he said, look, he said, you know, personal selling, like business, you know, if you're a sales guy, you want to get out there, you want to have connections and you want it to be meaningful. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that you do that is you involve your life.
Yes.
And you make yourself relatable.
Yes.
So I think that for some, in my opinion, I think for some people in certain industries, it could actually, it could actually work in your favor.
It humanizes you. It makes you more relatable. Yes. Here's another dimension to me, but don't, every post should not be promoting you or your company. Every post should not be, you know, your personal life. If you have a representative, you know, elements of that throughout, great. But, you know, you should lead with value. And so that should be educating, inspiring, right? Sharing your expertise. And then the other stuff can be included as well.
100%. I too built my dining room table. I think you just
did
inspired.
You?
I think you just inspired my my next LinkedIn post.
Fantastic.
We'll just start it. We'll start a niche.
I love it.
People who are creating their own dining room tables.
Very good.
Table talk.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and I do have one more question for you.
Yeah, so, fire away.
Podcast. I know you said you've been doing a podcast since 2015. Yeah. We've been doing ours for the last 2 years.
Uh-huh.
I do think that podcasts for B2B influencers is a huge, huge space. Anyone that's doing it interesting that you've seen, or do you think that, is it more of an audio, or do you think there's an element of visual that can happen there?
More and more podcasts are incorporating video.
Definitely. But does it make sense for B2B? That would be my question.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Right. Like, YouTube is the biggest podcast destination in the world now. And so having a video component is great. And then B, I think it's just, it's, you know, more engaging and more personal.
Yeah.
I switched my podcast from audio only to incorporating video late in the game. I don't know when it was. 2018, let's say.
It's easier to do now when everyone used to do it on Zoom.
Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of a treat to be able to do it.
For sure. Right? It's gotten diversified. And in-person is always better.
Yeah.
But you think, oh, making the switch, it'll be 10 times harder.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder. Maybe 2X or 4X, but it's not impossible.
Totally.
And so I think the value you get in exchange is strong. You asked who are the podcasters that I think are doing a good job. I'll tell you what I listen to. I love our friend Chris Irwin, right?
Yes.
My partner in crime, co-host for the event last night. He has an amazing podcast.
Yeah, he's got a good one.
Yes, from his team at Rockwater, where they talk about, it's called, why am I forgetting the name of it?
We'll cut this out.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's called The Come Up, right?
The Come Up, that's right.
Yes, where it talks about entrepreneurial stories, and I just love the branding and thought behind it. The other podcast I listen to, All In, right? Great, like macro landscape overview. And then the My First Million podcast, like what Sean and Sam do is just a lot of fun and like very conversational around sharing business ideas.
Oh, totally. And those are the ones that I think will be really interesting for B2B
100%.
Marketers, right? Because it's like you could go the NPR route, you could go the Planet Money route, you can do all that sort of stuff, but is it, that just feels that's a check the box. That's a programmatic buy, right? I think where you could have some really interesting conversations and do things like we could get, you know, you can get CEOs or CMOs or like, I'll talk about elevating employees, right? Thought leaderships, getting them on podcasts with these guys, I think would be really interesting. The conversational element of it is great. And then I also love, like one of the things that we obviously push our a lot of our clients towards is, hey, do the long form. Yeah, it's harder. It takes a little bit more setup. Do the long form because then it gives you all the short form. It gives you all the assets, all the cut downs. You can do audio clips. You can do video clips. You can do everything. We're going to do all that with this podcast, right? But that's what you've got to do because it is, I mean, it's hard to keep up with content, right? And people don't know what to post. But if you have this library of stuff, you can take clips and you can say, you know, you can do your LinkedIn post and then you can, you know, add the video
component Repurpose, mix and match. Totally.
Exactly. Yep. And to me, it's like that's the interesting thing. And I think we've also seen the trend on the B2C side, which I think really is B2B. It's not just everything. It's a general podcast trend, but it's like short form is the advertisement for it. And people are going crazy for it. But people also just consume a lot of clips and not like a, you know, hour and a half podcast because not everyone has. You know, how many hours a day do you have?
Yeah.
And you're not going to spend all of them listening to podcasts, right? So
the Tygo principle.
Yes, exactly.
I told this story about
this is a good one.
A podcast that I listened to, Throwing Fits. They effectively flew out to LA to shoot their podcast with Tyga, and he allotted them 15 minutes because he was like, oh, because his understanding of podcasts was just as, you know, as short form clips that he saw on Reels. He had no idea.
That's that amazing. No. 15 minutes is all
right,
you need.
Exactly. Yeah. Precisely. He had, you know, he had no concept of sort of, you know, of those being mined from a longer form conversation.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's telling, right? And I think probably a lot of people are doing it. And I mean, it's great to listen to just a quick clip and quick thing here and there. You know, TED Talk, obviously, that they were sort of the original inventors of that quick segment in a lot of ways. So I see a lot of that going on for sure.
Yeah.
But cool. Well, hey, great conversation. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. This has been so much fun.
Yeah, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.